Fashion Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined as ever by Phil Browning and Joe Kirk. Hello.
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 Hello, hello, hello. This week's session is a GDPR radio where we spoke about a lot, basically. We were just trying to refresh our memories on what we covered, and yeah, the list went on. So it went from GPs using ChatGPT to LinkedIn training its AI with user information and based on an opt-in rather than an opt-out actually rather than an opt-in. We also spoke about CCTV and audio and, you know, what the repercussions are around that. What did we also speak about? Help me.
ICO server study.
Yeah.
The
ICO rather action. Small sample group.
Yeah, the cookies and the Skybet issue. We talked about a complaint we'd had about Pecker, so we kicked that down for about 20 minutes, didn't we? About, you know, Pecker and LinkedIn, and that was quite an interesting discussion actually. Talked about SAR exemptions and how far management forecasting can be stretched. You know, that was that actually was my favorite topic, I think.
Yeah.
That was conceptually, that was quite good, because the example given on the ICO's website is fine, but when you read, you know, Article 22 GDPR, makes you think about, well, how far does it stretch and how long in terms of timescales it stretch. So we're going to do some further work on that, but that was my highlight. I don't know what yours were.
I think my highlight was talking about direct marketing, and, you know, there's one side of it in terms of email direct marketing compared to LinkedIn direct marketing and the issues around that. But I liked discussing whether, you know, we can do direct marketing on the live sessions, whether that is considered unsolicited direct marketing by electronic means or not. You know, we discussed the the factors at play. So, you know, it's a closed audience, but also is it directly going out to individuals? You know,
the recordings? Are the recordings different from the live sessions?
Yeah,
so, yeah, it was quite a good chat, that
it
was, wasn't it?
Complex. Yeah, yeah. What was yours, Joe?
I always enjoy talking about cookies, because I think it's very prominent at this stage of time.
I wondered where you were going with that.
This stage of my life.
But there's a lot of work going on in cookies, and I've been doing quite a lot of cookie work over the past 18 months or so, to be fair, with DPP. So I always enjoy talking about cookies. I did enjoy kicking around the stuff around direct marketing.
Phil's gone.
I did enjoy talking about direct marketing in relation to our podcast and whether it's, you know, considered to be a corporate subscriber or not. But Jasmine and Phil have gone, so I won't bore you anymore, and I won't delve into too much, because that will just take away from listening to the session. So I hope you find the session useful, and we will see you next week.
Good. Yeah, I had to do. I'm embarrassed to have to admit it, but I feel it's necessary to kind of get it on the table. I had to do a driver awareness training course on Wednesday morning.
What are you doing, speeding?
When I picked James Naylor up to take him down to the staff barbecue, I drove through Walton near Leeds, which is a country lane, and apparently there's three speed cameras on it. You know why? Because Leeds United's training ground is just around the corner from it. So I would clock doing 37 in the 30 zone on a country road. So anyway, I did my driver awareness training, and I did it got on like this. And the guy said, "Oh, you've got to turn your blurred background off." I said, "Why?" He said, "Data protection." I said, "Well, what do you mean data protection?" He said, "Well, we want to see if anybody's observing what's going on." And, you know, I said, "All right, fair enough. I'll take that off." And then he said, "And you've got to be in an isolated room. Nobody can come through and make you a cup of tea or anything like that." I said, "Why? Data protection." "What do you mean data protection?" He said, "Well, in case somebody who comes through recognizes anybody on the course." And actually, I thought it was quite a good point. Actually, I'd not thought of that perspective. So, it was interesting.
Did that mute you? I was going to say, I bet you were about to
I thought it might count against me. It might count against
me. So best to keep pushing.
In applying for the course, I found that West Yorkshire Police's cookie policy is all over the place. So now I've completed the course, I'm going to send them the email I drafted.
Get one up on them.
in anger at having been clocked for speeding. So I'm going to send that through this weekend. Anyway, that was the highlight of my week. No, the highlight of my week was being in the office. The highlight of my week was being in the office. But I've had a very, really, really, really busy week trying to get through some bits of paperwork, get some reports done. Read through, you know, it's been a busy week. What about you?
Well, the highlight of my week was turning my laptop on, I think it was Wednesday morning, maybe Thursday morning, and receiving a song over email.
Did you not work on Monday or Tuesday?
Yeah, but that wasn't the highlight. The highlight was hearing your wonderful voice with just, you know, in a GDPR related song that you will all hear at some point. So keep an ear out for that one because it will be worth it.
This is what I was talking about before the staff barbecue. I said we've modified the lyrics to New York, New York, and they're all GDPR related. Well,
it's
kind of.
It sounds, I promise you. It's hilarious. What have
and
you been
clean.
On with?
And clean.
Yeah. What have you been on with, Joe?
My week has been very bitty. So I've been in the middle of a DPA for one of our partners, actually, that Phil mentioned, to do with external attack surface. I should know what it stands for. EASM, yeah, external attack surface management platform, which is all to do with monitoring the dark web and looking for vulnerabilities and threats against an organization, and how you know, the employees of that organization may be at risk with what's found. So I've been trying to get that done, but this week I've just been pulled in so many different directions by some of my other customers who have needed my immediate attention to do with breaches and subject access requests, that I've not really had the time to kind of, that I'd have liked to kind of get down and really get some serious work done on it. We are coming towards the end of the project, which is good because I would like some time back to focus on other things. But yeah, my week's been really bitty, but always interesting. We've had, as Phil said, quite a few interesting cases the last couple of weeks that we're going to pick through, I believe, today. So, yeah, a good week, but bitty.
Sounds
very good. Now, we've got another interesting piece. We've got another really detailed cookie audit to do, which is going to be quite fun again. We actually, Katrina's doing that this time with Kane. But Joe and I did the last one. And we used, I think we mentioned a bit on the podcast, we used the OneTrust cookie tool to do that. Found lots of inconsistencies with it and weaknesses with it, but I think they've improved it since then. But to be fair, you know, we did do a lot of research, didn't we, Joe, to try and find other tools. We didn't find anything that was anywhere near as good as the OneTrust tool. Anyway, this client is a OneTrust user, so I think we're going to probably use the same techniques. But I said to Kane and to Kate that I have to go off and find the scope of work and the methodology we use and the output report, and just kind of use that as a basis to work with. But that'll be quite good again, because it was really detailed, wasn't it, and really quite hard, tough bit of work to do.
Yes, and very prominent, isn't it, in what the ICO is kind of focusing on at the moment, because I don't know if you saw in the news that Sky Betting Gaming were issued a reprimand, weren't they, I believe.
That's a superb slide through from one topic to another. Well done, Joe. I did notice that. Did you, Jasmine?
I thought you were reacting to the story itself, not Joe's transition.
Oh, Joe's transition was like a PowerPoint. It was
like I'd rehearsed it.
Exactly. Yeah. So what did they find, though? I mean, that was interesting, that Skybet cookie issue, wasn't it?
Yes. So they said that they were processing people's personal information and sharing it with advertising technology companies as soon as they accessed the Skybet website, before they had even had the option to accept or reject advertising cookies. So this meant that the personal information could be used to target them with personalized ads without prior consent or knowledge. The ITO said they investigated whether Skybet was deliberately misusing people's personal information to target vulnerable gamblers following a complaint from Clear Up Gambling. They said that no evidence of deliberate misuse was found. The regulator concluded that Skybet and Gaming was processing personal data through the use of certain cookies in a way that was not lawful, transparent, or fair. They said that SkyBet made changes in March 2023 to ensure people could reject advertising cookies before their personal information was shared for these purposes. And obviously this comes off the back of last year, they wrote, didn't they, to the top 100 websites that people in the UK visit. And they wrote to 53, I believe, to warn that they faced enforcement action if they did not make changes to advertising cookies to comply with data protection law. And it's been positive, and they said that 52 of the websites had made changes. I think there was one website called Tattle Life that has not engaged with them. And these changes refer to the addition of a reject all as well as a accept all button, and making sure that the buttons are neutral. So there's no like accept all is not green and reject all is not red. Kind of, I think it's called nudging and sludging, I think the phrase they used in the joint paper they did with the Competent Markets Authority. So it was actually a really interesting piece, and it's something that I've kind of been able to not say flex my muscles in cookies, but it's I've been able to kind of work quite a lot with cookies, and I think they're very prominent at the moment, and I think it's something that a lot of organizations are now starting to kind of realize that it's something that they need to improve on.
Yeah, but what was most interesting to me was the fact that the ICO took action under the GDPR, not the PECA. So they said the infringements were Article 5.1a, 6.1a and 7.1, which all relate to consent and transparency, lawfulness. So I was interested why they would have taken that approach rather than pursuing them under the PECA.
Maybe to up the statistics for GDPR reprimands, you know, with all of these marketing fines going out and reprimands.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, while I've been doing quite a bit of cookie work, I've actually found something out myself that I wasn't aware of previously, is that Regulation 6 of the PECA says that you have to provide clear and comprehensive information. And that's actually not defined in the PECA, but the e-privacy directive does define it. And it says it relates to the GDPR's transparency requirements. So that is probably why they then went under the GDPR as opposed to the PECA.
Well, it's also a reprimand because SkyBet had rectified. They said, oh, right, 2nd of March, ICO said, you got this issue. 3rd of March, they fixed it. 17th of March, the ICO checked it and said, yep, it's been fixed. So that's probably also something to do with it, you know, but it was probably, you know, the cooperation and the, you know, the way that SkyBet probably approached it, that it's a reprimand, not a fine, you know. So it's just interesting that they've taken that approach, though. So.
Peter's just left a similar comment in the chat, Phil, saying that you can only fine under the PECA, but it was resolved. It would have been harder to do so. So the ICO went for GDPR, as you can reprimand.
Yeah. Yeah. And Tim Turner apparently has done a big old thing about it, which is good. I haven't seen that, to be honest, but.
No, me neither.
Yeah. So I saw that. So that was your transition through from that was good. Now, I don't know if any.
Just before we move on, that is something that I've always wondered, you know, with cookies, when you enter a website and a cookie banner pops up and you might not respond straight away, you might carry on scrolling. I do always wonder, before you accept or reject, are cookies being collected at that point? Especially, you know, where you've got so on the banner you've got an X that you don't have to accept or reject. What happens then? You know, clearly in some instances, it means that the cookie is being used regardless. And I think that's always the presumption I take with these kinds of situations.
Yeah, I don't trust any of the cookie things that you see. And when you're scrolling through like 1,100 different advertisers or partners, whatever they call them, you know, to unconsent from them all or unlegitimate interest from them all. I'm not entirely sure I understand exactly what they're doing, you know. So if you object to all, then you click on the partners page and sometimes a legitimate interest, you know, what is it that they're doing? You know, why is the processing based on legitimate interest? You know, it doesn't really explain what's happening that the processing that legitimate interest is based on. But it possibly varies from person, organization to organization. But now I saw, this isn't a plug for this, but I'm quite interested to see if anybody else has seen it. There's a conference 28th of November in London, and also online, the Data Protection Conference run by Westminster Insight. And it looks like it might be quite good to attend. So I'm quite keen to attend that. It's £400 to attend, whether you're online or not. I'll put a link in here. But it seemed like it's quite an interesting agenda. So I'm only raising it because I thought if people hadn't seen it, they might also think, oh, that was quite interesting. but I'd noticed that. So I think I'm going to book. There's an early bird discount, I think, if you book in September. But it looks like it might be quite useful. That's assuming I can fit it in around all my audits I'm doing.
A busy man, as always. I want to flip the conversation on its head before we kind of dissect some of the queries that we've had to come in our way. I don't know if you saw, I saw a very alarming news story while I was doing some prep this week. And it's that one in five GPs uses AI, such as ChatGPT, for daily tasks, a survey found. So the key takeaway is that 1,006 GPs were surveyed and were asked whether they have ever used any form of AI chatbot in their clinical practice. And one in five says said they had, and 29% of those said they used AI to generate documentation after patient appointments, while 28% said they used the tools to suggest a different diagnosis. And a quarter of respondents said they used AI tools to suggest treatment options.
Wow. That's surprising, is that?
I think that's astonishing. And obviously, that was a very small sample. I don't know how many GPs there are within the UK, but I imagine it's a lot more than 1,006. And I imagine that that is probably mirrored across the rest of the country. But I just, when I came across it, I don't know, it's just it's staggering to me.
Surprising.
I think it depends on how they're using it, because, you know, if we were to ask a question about data protection, we have the knowledge to decide whether it's true or if it's, you know, false, I suppose, if it's incorrect. You know, if they're using that to just prompt them to go down the right path, then I can't see it being too much of an issue, as long as they're not putting in personal data and, you know, they have that awareness. But I can't say with confidence that that's the case even, you know, because not all, I don't know if in the healthcare sector data protection is you know, always a bit, what's the word,
always considered,
yeah, as much as it should be. Yeah
I mean, going off that, it says that they used AI to generate documentation after patient appointments, one would think that they were inputting personal data. And I think that's where the underlying issue is right now, is that I don't think people are aware of the consequences of putting such information in AI chatbots such as ChatGPT. You know, the risks of these chatbots or generative AI models having, you know, special category data is, I don't know. I don't know what they do with the data, but it can't be good, though, can it?
You know, that's the thing. You know, people are putting in personal data of different levels of sensitivity or whatever it is, and you don't know what's happening with it. You can't delete it. You know, you can't request that it's deleted. So people's rights can't be enforced through using it. But also, there's so many questions still around how that information is actually handled. I don't even think some of these organisations have the answers from a data protection standpoint that, you know, would provide some clarity and some reassurance, because it doesn't exist. So I think only moving forward with legislation will control how people's data is handled within that, and it'll probably limit AI in certain ways. It must do it. That's the only plausible explanation to me. You're definitely both reading the chat.
No, I'm not. I'm reading, because we put a question into chat yesterday when we were in the office about the use of SSL secure socket layer under the PCI DSS. We were just testing whether what we got back from the chat, and we're unconvinced that the chat actually gave us a proper answer. You know, it said that SSL was fine for use in the PCI DSS, you know, for encrypting cardholder data, and it isn't. You know, it's very clear the requirement says that, although it does say that early SSL, in fact, it says using SSL or early TLS, you know, is not not permitted. But the chatbot was saying, yeah, no, it's fine. And we rephrased the question three times. It still came back with, yeah, it's fine. And I'm absolutely convinced it's not fine. So, you know, definitely errors, you know, especially in technical topics, which medicine is probably a technical topic.
Yeah, definitely. That's what worries me about. I'm assuming everybody's seen the AI summary on Google now. So when you search anything, you know, there's a summary at the top of basically what you might find by looking in the articles below. And I take that with a pinch of salt as well, because, you know, that it summarizes it for one, and I don't think that chatbots are good for summarizing at all. I think sometimes they touch on the wrong points, and that might be through putting, you know, an article that I've made it and ask it to summarize into a paragraph or something. It doesn't know what the highlights and the main elements are necessarily, and yeah, I don't even know where I was going with that, but
well, yeah, but what the point you make is great, and that's the issue that I have, that GPs are using, you know, functions such as ChatGPT to provide diagnosis, as if me and you, and you know, we're not comfortable with the advice they're given around data protection law. How as a GP can you put the trust in something that's just scanned the internet? And we know, how often have you been under the weather and you've Googled your symptoms and it's told you that you're going to die within 3 months?
That's very true.
Do you know what I mean? So and GPs are using this information that's been pulled from sources via ChatGPT to then diagnose patients. It's absolutely absurd. And what if you then give a diagnosis to somebody saying that, oh, you know, you've only got a few months to live, and that you know, that would cause a huge amount of stress. They've got to be very careful, and it's, I'd be surprised to not see some sort of watchdog investigation in this, because it's, I don't know, it just seems incredibly, incredibly wrong.
Yeah. Andrew said in the chat, what if only ignorant people allow their data to be used for AI training? And yeah, I'm thinking the same thing. So I want to move on to what I'm sure most people have heard about this week, is that LinkedIn have had, you know, an automatic opt-in for collecting user data to train its AI. And, you know, users, I suppose, have to opt out. I think they've changed it now, so it's like a toggle where, you know, it's automatically on opted out. But Joe, I'll let you go into this. You saw a post on LinkedIn, didn't you, that gave a really interesting perspective?
Yeah, and it backs up what Andrew's kind of questioning here. It was from Richard Merigold. He said, so this is a quote from his post. He said, now this poses an interesting dilemma for me. Firstly, I don't appreciate that it was set to yes automatically, and because it was, I feel like I want to turn it off. On the flip side, if I don't leave it on, the tool will continue to be trained on other data regardless. Data, views, opinions, and indeed facts that may or may not align with my own. So he said, if I don't allow my data to be used to train such tools, then I can't expect my views or opinions to be taken in. And as such, if ever use these tools and don't like or disagree with their responses, can I ever actually moan if I chose for my data not to be included in the training? We're creating a very interesting choice for people. Be involved, preferably by a clear choice, or let future information resources be created without our own views being taken into account. Possibly a bit deep for a Wednesday morning. Are you in or out? Is what he said.
It sounds interesting. It sounds like there's kind of somebody's pushing an argument towards it being in the public interest to have everybody opted in.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's the kind of the balance, isn't it? If, you know, do you want your opinions to be taken into consideration, or are you happy for AI to pull people's opinions that you don't necessarily agree with, and
surely
possibly will
not
be wrong?
Surely it's not a black and white choice. Surely they're just not, those two aren't the only options. I mean, yes, consent is in or out, but
I think it also comes down to, you know, a lot of people are opting out because they don't trust what's being done with the data, and it's the privacy concerns around, you know, the use of the data, which is why they don't want to be a part of it. I think if that was you know, more promising and provided more reassurance, then more people in this call probably would be more likely to opt in. I remember speaking about cookies like a couple of years ago, and in my head, you know, cookies turned out to be the enemy because sometimes you can't reject them. And I remember Ollie, who used to work for us, saying, you know, he'll accept them if it's on a website that he's, you know, that he'd like to receive related ads for, because if he's going to receive ads anyway, they may as well be related to him and, you know, suggest things that he likes, which I thought, oh, fair enough, you know. There are positives and there are reasons for it, rather than just the businesses or organizational websites' commercial interests, you know.
So what is it that's being used then for the AI training? People's posts or?
People's posts and personal data, yeah.
Content, you know, their CVs, yeah. And
I think, am I right in thinking it's LinkedIn, or is it Meta? I think it might be Meta now that's also including people's comments to train AI. So pretty much everything, really.
It's quite worrying, isn't it?
You know, as you were explaining
that. What the output
of
that's going to be.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking, whilst you were talking before, Joe, that... So it's my opinion that, say, with social media, for example, if there's something going on in the world that, let's say, something political, and I know for a fact that people who I've got, say, on Instagram, for example, do not follow politics. Like, there's just not something they're interested in. But there'll be something that's going round, and they reshare it to the point where this one post or this opinion becomes many people's opinions. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's something that they've not delved into themselves, and they've not decided, they've been influenced by what other people are posting and things like that. So if now AI is taking this information and seeing that as the majority opinion and might then change that to fact, I think that's also very dangerous.
Steph said, are we talking data protection or intellectual property?
I don't know if it's intellectual property. I think it's just past.
Are we talking data protection? We're talking data protection, aren't we?
Yeah.
Complicated. Don't know.
I think it's, if anything, it might relate to data accuracy if it starts to take this as, you know, a certain opinion as fact due to the majority saying, this is the case, because how else, you know, do they get information wrong when we ask for advice on data protection or whatever it is, that they're collecting misinformation and making decisions on that to feed back to us?
Yeah, but accuracy in relation to data protection is that opinion accurately reflected, rather than is that opinion accurate in terms of the facts? You know, so I'm not sure accuracy in the context of data protection works, because, you know, I am accurately displaying my opinion, which is completely incorrect compared to the facts. Mm. Like, they're eating cats or whatever it was they said.
Okay, take it.
Like Donald Trump.
They're eating all the cats.
I think to take it back a step then they're collecting this personal data and making decisions based on that, you know, they're misinterpreting people's opinions, which is, you know, collecting personal data rather than collecting information through articles and other means. I don't know.
I think I might want to do some reading on this and then come back to it in a fortnight when we've got another.
It's just very hypothetical the way we're going.
Yeah, it's good. Good. Do you mind if I kind of change tack? If everyone's to talk about this further, then fine. But I don't know if you saw that the ICO published the results of a data controller survey this week. Let me find the link. Really interesting. But the sample size was 20 organizations, 20 data controllers, which I thought was a small sample. They say that it's a representative sample, but I can't imagine how 20 controllers, over a million registered, which I think is a drop in the ocean compared to the number of data controllers that there actually are in the country. There's a million registered on the register, or they say over a million. But if it was over 2 million, surely they say over 2 million. But I reckon there must be 5 million corporate organisations in the UK, you know, businesses, registered with Company House. Maybe they're not all data controllers, maybe some are dormant, etc. Anyway, there's 20 that have contributed to the survey. But interesting, the sample was 74 sole traders, 74% sole traders, 19% micro-organisations. So they have got quite a good spread of, you know, small organizations. But you should have a look at it, because it's really quite interesting what they're saying, you know, estimated annual turnover, attitude towards data protection, amount of resources they put against data protection, the number of data subjects. 48% of the respondents reported processing fewer than 100 individuals in the last 12 months, which is very small, isn't it? Maybe it's because 74% are micro-organizations, sole traders. But getting interesting survey. But what was, I think, fascinating was that 16% felt very familiar with data protection law, and 48% fairly familiar with data protection, which is a high proportion to over 50% saying, yeah, we're pretty familiar with data protection law. Not surprising, I suppose, public sector organizations are more likely to report familiarity with data protection law than a private sector, potentially because they've got FOIA and other regulatory things around that, and they've got more governance fabric, and maybe they're bigger. But the most interesting thing for me was that 32% said that they saw data protection as an enabler. 24% said a constraint, and 16% said both. And I thought that was higher than I expected. I expected a lot of the respondents, although they're only being 20, saying, you know, it's a big problem, it's a constraint, it's a pain in the backside, because the way the former government was saying, oh, this is just a real problem for business, we're going to have to water it down. The negatives I see are hardware and software costs, which I get, you know, it's quite expensive to put in proper systems, you know, web application firewalls or whatever other protections you've got. No negative, the compliance training costs. But I don't see that as a negative. I think that's one of the costs of doing business, isn't it? Training isn't relevant stuff. And then time spent on compliance activities. They were the three negatives that people put forward. The positives: improving the trust of customers, clarity on DP compliance, and streamline existing practices. Quite interesting. But the way they got it on, it's got like a business and Microsoft BI interactive graph you can click on on the ISO website. I'll put a link through to it, but I don't know if you did see that survey?
No.
I didn't. No, I missed that. But I mean, what does that actually tell you, though? Because like you said, I mean, how can they say that 20 data controllers is a representative of over a million? And of course, the small organizations are going to, you know, have issues in relation to price they pay on software and training and finding time to do admin tasks. Because if you're a sole trader, you're on your own. You know, you've got to do your tasks as a, you know, at the business to make money. Data protections, you're not even going to think about it, are you? So I just... it just seems a little bit unfair to kind of use such a small sample and 74% of those at least to be sole traders or micro organizations. It just,
it says, you know, the representative sample included. So this, you know, representative of what? You know, can't over 20 orgs, you can't represent all sectors. You could represent all sizes of organization, but you cannot say that's representative. It's certainly not a significant sample. But again, quite interesting stuff in there. You know, if you have the time to flick through it, they do have an infographic about it for the key takeaways, which is also quite interesting to have a look at.
Yeah, let's have a look at that.
Yeah, it is hard to get past the, you know, the size of the survey, though. I can't, like you said,
I wonder why it was so small. I wonder why they
got 20. The more the better, right? Always, because it gives you a wider range of. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, shall we dissect some interesting cases that we've had come our way in the past couple of weeks?
Yeah, so there's a few things that I wanted to kind of flag up. One was we had a complaint this week about you know, reaching out to people under the pecker. So I think it's quite interesting to talk through that because you know, it's made us have a look and think about our processes as well. So that's one that I want to try and pick up. Joe and I have been doing some looking at SAR exemptions this week, and we want to just chat through the management forecasting one in particular. That's another thing. What else have we had? I had verbal disclosure. Is that GDPR this week with Kane? What have you had this week?
I've had a couple of interesting ones about CCTV. One of them was a lot more interesting than the other, and another one regarding a personal data breach that involved courts disclosing personal information about a domestic abuse victim and someone who's been assisting them in a legal aid case to the perpetrator.
Yeah.
So quite a few to, I mean, take your pick of which ones you'd like to begin and we'll see if we've got time to divulge any others.
Well, so I'll start with the, I mean, we could end up spending the whole next rest of the session on PECA now, but at risk of doing that. So we had decided we were going to run a campaign to promote our DPIA masterclass. And Ben, one of our business execs, thought that the best warm audience might be subscribers to the podcast, on the assumption that they might either know people who they think should attend or might even want to attend themselves. So he kind of put this campaign together and he thought, right, first of all, the thing I'll do is send out an email. Then I might make a phone call and I might also reach out on LinkedIn. So he did an email and then a LinkedIn contact, you know, connection. And then I think he sent a message saying, you know, interested in the course to a podcast listener. And they kind of came back and said, you know, not sure this is lawful to do this. So it got escalated to me. So I got involved and I said, George, hear about your complaint. And, you know, the person who complains, I'm not actually complaining as such. I'm just really interested to explore the rationale and the logic. So I thought that's really good, actually. So, you know, apologized because I think, you know, if we've upset people, that's not what we're trying to do, is it? But I was just interested in how we kind of thought through the process. And I said, I'm not going to insult your intelligence and try and bamboo you a load of, you know, nonsense. You know, basically, yes, we may well have got this one wrong. So in terms of sending out an email, you know, we it was to a business address. So as far as we're concerned, you know, that's a B2B outbound unsolicited direct marketing email. In the B2B context, then that doesn't require consent. You could do that under a legitimate interest. Equally, making a phone call, unless they're in both cases, prior objection to marketing processing. And in the case of a phone call, CTPS or TPS listed, again, it's fair game, isn't it? If it's a person-to-person mm-hmm. phone call, you don't need consent. So we were probably okay there. But when it came to reaching out on LinkedIn, a number of questions arose. One was connecting with somebody marketing. Well, it's the start of a campaign. So in the ICO's books, it might well be part of a marketing campaign. You know, did we have consent? Podcast listener, not sure we do. You know, we do get people to opt in to subscriptions to the podcast, but we don't actually seek or have records of consent. So I was looking at that and I thought, well, maybe by attending is kind of a clear affirmative action, which is doesn't have to be a ticky box, does it? It can be a clear affirmative action. So by attending, potentially, you know, that could be classed as consenting, but consenting to what? Consenting to this type of processing in the podcast, or consenting to other use of the data after the podcast or around the podcast. And it probably doesn't cover that. Also, I'm not sure it's in our privacy notice for the podcast, but it is in our privacy notice on our website, but we don't refer to that in the sign-up form. So there's a lot of things that came out of this. And then I said, well, you know, because I said, well, maybe soft opt-in applies. And he said, well, if I've not been asked to consent at any point in this journey, then soft opt-in can't apply. It's one of the ICO's rules. So it's flagged up some really interesting points. And again, I thought out of, you know, what we're like, we're pretty transparent. We're quite happy to talk through our own issues as well as other people. So, you know, a bottom line is that stepping through the pecker is a nightmare. You know, so if you can contact a person via a B2B email and then by phone and it's not a problem, but then when you want to connect to them via LinkedIn, it is a problem and it's all part of the same campaign. That doesn't seem quite right. Although I absolutely respect people's privacy on the LinkedIn platform, they don't want to hear from us. If they did, they'd contact us. So just interesting to kick it around. Now, we had a call with the ICO about this in February 2023. Vicky Lawson rang them because at that point they said they updated their B2B marketing guidance and said, in terms of professional networking sites, we think that people use them in their personal capacity, therefore it's not B2B marketing. So Vicky rang them up and they said, Jennifer, yes, I would suggest that given our guidance on the individual using LinkedIn and blah, 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 it's not appropriate. You know, so Vicky said, well, how would you recommend we get that consent? And the ICO, Jennifer, said, perhaps you could look at making a live telephone call to see if they wanted to opt in or not. So I'm only raising it. I know rambling on a bit, so I'm going to stop. But just raising it because it came up this week and I thought it was really interesting that, you know, essentially we can send messages out to our contacts via LinkedIn, via email, but not send out messages to our contacts via LinkedIn.
It is complicated, isn't it?
Which, of course, everybody knows, but I just thought I'd throw it out there and, yeah, you know.
Like, looking at LinkedIn, you know, we're obviously connecting with people in a professional capacity, but it is still a personal account. And I suppose...
I think the issue is that they're not necessarily using LinkedIn for a professional capacity. You know, the ICO said they're using it to further their own careers as individuals rather than strictly for the use of their business, which is probably true.
Yeah. Joe, you look like you had something to say there.
I was just going to say, but it's a corporate platform, isn't it? And at the time, you are... I don't know, it's just... I think LinkedIn stuff's tricky, and I think as wrong as it is that this kind of just like a standard like acceptance of all users that by using it, I know it's not right, but by using it, you kind of expect to be marketed to, whether it's for a role or for a service. It's kind of just, it's a little bit like an unwritten rule. And I'm not trying to use it as an excuse, but yeah, I don't know. I just think trying to navigate direct marketing through LinkedIn is not easy. I think we've had a conversation on here before, haven't we, actually, about it. And we've tried to kind of unpick it. And I think I'm sure of someone's disclosed before on here that it has it in LinkedIn's terms that by using it, you kind of consent into, you know, individuals reaching out to you for the purposes of direct marketing and to recruit you. And again, that's not lawful either, because LinkedIn shouldn't be collecting the consent, and it's not freely given, is it, either? So yeah, I don't know. It's interesting, and I think the point of why we're raising this is just to probably make people aware that just you've got to be so careful, haven't you, with the sort of practices that you do internally as an organisation.
Yeah, I think with LinkedIn, it's one of those. It's a prime place for, you know, I'm not going to say monkey see, monkey do. I don't mean it in a disrespectful way, but I'm sure most people receive sales related messages all the time, you know, whether it's sponsored ones or whether it's just direct from some individual. And I think it's easy, especially for sales teams, to fall into the trap of thinking, oh, that's normal practice. You know, so many other people are doing it, I can do it too. And it's just something to be aware of, you know, maybe ask the sales team.
it's an urban myth inside salespeople that seem to, you know, get it baked into them, and they're when they're being trained or whatever, that information in the public domain is there for them to use. It's fair game, but it's not, is it? We know it's not. And the GDPR points to it not being right through Article 14. You know, if you obtain data from somebody other than the data subject, you have to tell them within a reasonable time frame that what you're doing with it and the source of the data. And it also says, you know, if it's impossible to tell them the source because it's come from various sources, then you've got to give them general information should be provided. So the GDPR doesn't say, no, you can't do this, use data in the public domain. It just says if you're going to, then there's some conditions and some hoops you got to jump through, which again, people, you know, give the GDPR a bad rap, or you can't do it. Well, you can, it's just a bit complicated.
And there's two perspectives, isn't there? There's the you know, the side from someone wanting to call around and make sales as a salesperson, and then there's when you are the target, and that can be the same person. And you know, you've got to remind yourself of that sometimes as well. I think if you're in that position, if there weren't these extra measures, you'd be hounded yourself. It's funny as well, like obviously working in the sales office, seeing the reaction from receiving a sales call to making a sales call, especially when Dave used to work in the office.
So I mean, there's a few things that came up, which is really quite interesting. So you know, we were saying, well, thinking is training trying to promote training services, if we're thinking soft opt-in, is promoting training services similar to the podcast? You know, we do say that the podcast is there for, it's not a selling tool, is it? It's more of a development tool. And the fact you can accumulate IAPP credits for attending would suggest it's kind of something to do with training development. So I would have said that, you know, trying to sell our training services is probably similar enough. But again, in the pecker, it's just a huge world of grey, isn't it?
And as well, you know, delving into that, people join for different reasons. You know, some people just join for, you know, the conversation, the community, and then others, you know, join to develop their own understanding of things. So
So I've thrown it out there. So if anybody has got any, you know, issues, complaints or comments, then we're happy to receive them. We're happy to try and do things, you know, as compliantly as we can. So I thought out of, you know, just the way we are, I thought I'd flag it up and kick it about.
Yeah. Alternatively, if you want to buy our training, even... that was another thing I wanted to discuss, actually, because I was thinking the other day, is this, if I was to mention, for example, a training course that we've got coming up on the podcast, would that be included within electronic?
It's not direct, is it? You're not sending a message to a specific individual, you know. It's like a banner advertising that.
Yeah, but you could say that almost about a mail merge, you know. If I'm directing that to the 86 people in this call, does that not, is that not enough?
No, I think it's different. Yeah, otherwise you'd say, well, the banner ad is to every person who happens to visit the website. I think I mean you actually, it's a good point you raised, because it could be that, because we've got a closed audience, it could be that that would be classed as direct. You know, we're promoting something to the 86 participants.
We'll just maybe go down the route it's not. No, it is interesting though. I think my head kind of fell off the other day thinking about it, because, you know, say for example me, I'll be speaking directly to people listening within this call, and obviously where do you draw the line with that? Because if you send out, I don't know, oh, what's Ben said, only a closed audience until you publish the podcast online.
Yeah,
that is available to everyone to listen back.
Pull rather than push. You might say, well, this is more akin to a telephone. Would you telephone conversation than?
I don't know, because
an electronic message.
We've got the chat.
It's interesting to think through.
Yeah, it's tricky.
I would say it is direct marketing personally. I think because it's defined as direct marketing means a communication by whatever means of advertising or marketing material which is directed to particular individuals, and our listeners are particular individuals.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'd go with that actually. Yeah, I'd go with that interpretation, Joe. Yeah.
So does that mean that it's, you know, via electronic means, or like you say, feel like a phone call?
Well, this is electronic means, isn't it?
Yeah, I know, but so that would be included within it then.
Whether it's someone
via our soft phone, you know,
is it messaging or is it phone? Well, that's phone, isn't it?
But this is a call.
Person to person. This is like one to many person to people call, probably. Yeah, it's interesting to think about. We need to kick that one around.
Maybe we need to stop promoting training. But if anyone would like to consent, I probably can't ask that either, to be honest. it is interesting.
A couple of comments in here, just reading the comments. So Joe, just we had a look at the management forecasting exemption, didn't we, earlier on today?
We did.
I might come back to your comments if once I've read them, need to think about them as well. So we had a client that was trying to handle some subject tax requests. They had an internal investigation and they felt that the personal data could be withheld from disclosure because it was subject to an internal investigation, and disclosure of that information might prejudice their internal investigation. They wondered, you know, was there an exemption that could be applied? And, you know, we weren't sure there was one that was directly applicable. I think we thought they'd quoted, although it was unclear where the reference came from, this section 45, which applies to the law enforcement processing of investigations. But we just kind of started to think about whether management forecasts could be used. Now, the examples given for management forecasts are generally kind of a redundancy situation. You know, we're going to reorganize. We've got a list of people whose roles or list of roles might be redundant and the people that it affects. Anybody asking for information about the redundancy program, you know, it would scupper our, this is what the ICO says in their guidance, isn't it? But because the management forecast is kind of described as business activities rather than, you know, it says the listed GDPR provisions do not apply to the personal data process for the purpose of management forecasting or management planning in relation to a business or other activity, to the extent the application of those provisions would be likely to prejudice the conduct of the business activity. Now, if the business activities is doing an internal investigation, is it possible that we could say, well, you know, the disclosure of data, personal data, to the requester that would prejudice that business activity? You know, does management forecasts, section 22 of Schedule 2, could it potentially, we only discussed it this morning, so we need to do some work on it. Could it be extended out to include that kind of business activity? So we're going to do a paper on it. We're going to put some arguments together for and against. We're going to think about the impact on data subjects. But it was just interesting, you know, it's all fresh off the press, this interesting about it. And we thought we would throw it out there today. David's got his hand up. I'm going to read the chat while David
Which side are you coming from? So we've definitely looked at some of those exemptions and used some of those exemptions in very, very similar circumstances. Normally we have, or potentially we have, an active internal investigation at the same time as we've got an external person challenging us for why they may or may not be leaving the organisation. And if you've got both going on at the same time, you might not use business planning, but you can probably use negotiation because you haven't completed the negotiation, because they're suing you for exit. So there's those pieces. We also looked at some external exit legal advice on some of the things that we were thinking here.
Yeah.
And they basically said that if you've got, so we, most of ours are done under a speaking up policy, okay? And a speaking up policy is not possible. Well, one, it's, you say it's anonymous, therefore you've got a duty of confidentiality. The ICO says you don't have to disclose where you've got a clear duty of confidentiality. Mm. So we refuse in a lot of cases to disclose anything on investigations. If it's a speaking up type investigation, if any of those on a number, and then there are a number of other things that you could go that generally speaking up, there's the risk of personal interaction. So is there a risk of harm? Definitely that is an area. I think there's loads you can look at. There are definitely a number of exemptions that I have been involved in utilizing that the people involved may have gone to and asked for further clarification. And as yet, nobody is. I've had discussions with the ICO. I will absolutely say everything is unique. Every circumstance is unique. But the way that we put it together, they supported the position around bits of it. So I think you're along the right lines. There are definitely some things there, but I think it's probably more around how do you do internal investigations if nobody has the ability speak without it being just disclosed back, because potentially it discloses somebody's personal information. So we did it around that duty of confidentiality piece, which the ICO definitely speaks about.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, that's good. We kind of highlighted potentially five of the exemptions, the kind of third parties subject to the reasonableness test. We thought, well, if it is kind of a speaking up, and then that could apply. In this particular case, it could be allegations of child abuse. So that would be kind of a crime and taxation, the Schedule 2, Section 2, Part 1, Section 1, which is kind of the general one. We thought negotiations in certain circumstances, legal professional privilege, although in this case, they don't seek much legal advice, or management planning. So we said what we would do for the client is put together a kind of a paper exploring the boundaries and giving some examples. But yeah, it's good to know that you've kind of been down this path, David. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, the first one is probably one of the main ones, the third party one. If they don't know who spoke about them and any chance that it would disclose them, that's almost.
Yeah.
Absolutely always take the step of everyone gets stepped through individually. They're all unique, they're all different, and we have enough blanket of a volume of them that have got experience, but we don't just go, oh, we're not going to do that. Everyone has that check, but they're the types of things that we look at. We frequently, if the people don't know who it is, won't do anything out of the interviews, and then all the other bits dependent where it is in the process. And you've got to reconsider if we've completed our processes, does that change any of the decisions if they come back in? Because potentially management planning goes away. Although actually, if you look at management planning, I would suggest that one of the two of them is definitely time bound. The other one doesn't necessarily give an example of time of it being time bound, suggests that if it continues to cause you issue. So if what you would disclose would cause you issue in your management working, then potentially you could still refuse to disclose it. But it's very challenging, but definitely they're the areas we've looked at in detail.
Yeah, we kind of, the gut feel was if it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't right. And it didn't feel right that there wasn't any way of kind of restricting or throttling back the disclosure information in those circumstances, if it's a serious case. I said to Joe, if it's like who's been moving the teacups around the kitchen, that's not that serious, is it? But if it's a serious allegations of abusive behavior or something, then there ought to be something that protects the other individuals in the organization. We're talking in a call with the person that does the redactions, and we said, the third parties, because they said, oh, do you mean like names? Well, there's much more than that. Anything that could indicate the identity of that third party.
If we feel it falls into those sections and abusive behavior, they wouldn't be getting a thing because of the risk to herself from disclosure to another person. So we wouldn't even be talking about redaction. We'd be talking about what do we even look at revealing. So we wouldn't even be redacting some of that information. We just wouldn't be putting in there for the risk to the third party. The exception is an exception to the SAR. So why would you even redact? It's an exception. So we take the whole sections out. So we do it much more there than going, oh yeah, well, no, absolutely. We very rarely provide anything with any names in it. If we're providing SARs, it's virtually always heavily redacted.
One of the questions.
Very specific circumstances. I'm always virtually always involved only when it's, people discipline people type cases, yeah. So they're always quite challenging and complex.
Yeah.
I'm suggesting this is how you would answer every SAR, but definitely those areas.
Yeah. The other thing I asked, well, how long do these investigations typically take? And they said anything from 3 months to several years.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, I think we'd have to have a look at the time frame here. You couldn't possibly have the law allowing controllers to hide for years behind, you know, an exemption. That doesn't feel right. So there's definitely a balance to be struck. Anyway, we thought that we might be just interesting to throw it out there and get people thinking about it, talking about it. Back to the Pekka thing. Owen has said that he thinks, you know, mentioning things on the podcast is probably okay, but then trying to approach them afterwards is probably not okay. So that's quite a good way of looking at it. But it also, it's, you know, a nightmare to navigate the Pekka. And Steph's saying
on that point though, so it definitely is direct marketing, you know, messaging afterwards. But if it's B2B, then it's under a legitimate interest, isn't it? So I would say that's okay, unless someone was to opt out.
Yeah, except back to the point about LinkedIn platform.
Not including LinkedIn. Yeah, Owen, do you want to unmute?
Yeah, sorry. To clarify what I meant there was, I think because the podcast itself is obviously open for anybody to kind of join or whatever, I think the issue would be, so saying it on the podcast is fine because the way the people join it, if, for example, you were to start emailing people who you want to join the podcast purely to market to them with the intention of marketing the podcast, that's where it becomes like the direct marketing, because although you don't mention it in the email, your intention
it's all
is
part
to
of the campaign
to them. So because I've had that before where we host events, and I always say to the guys who kind of want to market out our events, are we selling in that event? Because if we are, then that email is marketing that we're going to send, because although we don't mention we're going to be selling in the event, we plan to do so.
Yeah, the ICO has said before they think that's all part of a campaign, don't they? They've made that position quite clear.
It's an absolute nightmare to navigate, so
thank you for that.
That's right.
Steph, no affiliation with parts of the program, talks, conferences, right? Okay, yes. Some good stuff in the chat there. Now then, what else have we got then? We've only got a few minutes left. What else have we got to talk about today?
Well, I did have a query, but I don't think 4 minutes is going to quite cut it. I mean, we could try fly through if you want.
Yeah, I think we should.
I've got one other thing, but we'll talk
about CCTV. So a customer of mine came to me with quite a, not I say complicated query, but. So there was a report within a block of flats regarding parcels going missing. So a member of staff checked CCTV to see if they could identify any theft. And in doing so, came across CCTV footage that actually included audio. So within the audio, it was picked up that a contractor was talking to tenants about the member of staff who was looking back at the footage, saying along the lines of, she's a good looking girl, but he's a bit soft on the tenants. So this actually upset the member of staff. So the customer wanted to see if they could do anything about this. Just a little bit more context. The signage of the CCTV within where the CCTV is does not state that CCTV camera also picks up audio. But it is detailed in the privacy policy, though, saying that from time to time, we may operate CCTV/sound recording and or use photography to capture evidence of breach of tenancy, alleged antisocial behaviour or crime. And they just wanted to know whether the controller could do anything in this instance.
Okay, so to paraphrase that, there was a tenant asked, what was it? A tenant asked for CCTV.
No, so there'd just been reports of parcels going missing. So they just went back to have a look to see if it was theft.
And then they heard some negative comments about themselves.
Or
comments they didn't like about themselves.
From another member of staff?
From a contractor, so a third party, to a tenant.
About that member of staff watching it?
Yeah.
That's really unfortunate.
It is, yeah.
What are the chances of that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, my initial thoughts with that are that if they're not informing people, you know, that they're collecting that type of information or they're going to use it in a certain way, then they probably shouldn't use it in, you know, in that instance. But I think that doesn't resolve the issue in this case. You know, the it could come about to the contractor that the member of staff has heard them say this through the CCTV, and you know that this data, that his, or I'm assuming his, but his or her data has been processed, then you know that's got risk in it as well. So for me, it would be a matter of being transparent as possible, probably not, you know, taking it further from, I suppose, a HR perspective with, you know, with I suppose complaining or taking any disciplinary action.
Yeah.
But still, you know, trying to resolve the issue so both parties can move past it and, you know, feel confident.
Yeah. And I think that was the avenue that I went down, was the fact that you can't really do anything specifically with the contractor because, you know, you haven't made them aware. Although it is in the privacy policy, it's not on the foot, the signage. So I think we went down the kind of route that you might be best kind of just sending out like a generic thing to all staff saying, look, just be mindful of, you know, what you're doing and what you're saying. And that, you know, these things may get picked up that could lead to that. I think that's the best way to go and handle that.
I think the recording in a public area is, Toby quite right, it says, you know, it's very hard to justify. Was it accidental? They didn't realise that audio recording was...
Yeah. They didn't know.
That camera was configured.
The current DPO didn't know, but it was installed previously. But it is in the privacy policy, but it's not on the signage. So it's just inconsistencies. And I just kind of wanted to reiterate the point that it's so important, isn't it, that what you're doing needs to be covered in your privacy policy and, you know, if you need it, your signage as well.
Yeah. It's a tricky situation when, you know, something happened that you're not complying with the GDPR and you know, it's had a negative effect, but all you can do is try and mitigate that circumstance and prevent it from happening in the future and, you know, take the opportunity to review what you do and what your practices are and how you can improve them. Moral of the story.
I'm afraid we've run out of time. I wanted to talk through, it was interesting reading Scott v. LGBT, but we'll say that for next time. Had to reread that because we were talking about verbal disclosures, Clamerton about verbal disclosures. But in reading that, I found some interesting views that the judges expressed about vital interests, which seemed to be contrary to the ICO's view. So we'll save that for next time.
No, it sounds good. Thanks for the thanks for the brief.
Trailer. Oh no, that's selling.
So thank you so much everyone for joining. We hope you enjoyed the session. We will be back next week for a session on international transfers part 2. So either catch up on the first one or you know, join us to continue the conversation on the next one.
We've got the 10 scenarios to talk through from the ICO.
Yeah, it's not a quiz. It's not.
Definitely not a quiz. No, we have bad track record of quizzes on here.
Yeah, very bad. And I think they're just cursed as well at this point. But so yeah, anyway, have a great weekend in the meantime and we will see you next week.
Thank you very much,
guys.
Yeah. See you later.
Bye.